There have been several examples of the use of the name Flying Tigers. It is a catchy name, you have to admit. It combines our love of flying with our love of fierce animals and, I suppose, our love of kitty cats. In this hour, we'll talk about the Flying Tigers of World War II, a group of American pilots who volunteered to go to China to fly combat missions against the Japanese. One small hitch, the work started before the attack on Pearl Harbor when the United States was still officially neutral. So the history of the Flying Tigers is a bit more complicated than you might think. Samuel Kleiner catches us up in a new book called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Sam Kleiner is a lawyer and a writer based in New York City. His work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times and The Atlantic, among others. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. Pleasure to be with you.
So is this a story you grew up with, or one of those, whoa, we did what things later in life?
Well, it's a mix of both. My grandfather was a navigator on a B-25 in the Pacific. He actually grew up in Tacoma, Washington, and still lives there. I grew up down in Tucson, Arizona, and remember talking to my grandfather about, you know, his service in the war, going out with him when he came to visit to the Pima Air and Space Museum, and just kind of grew up with this fascination with World War II and particularly the war in the Pacific. And then when I was doing my dissertation at the University of Oxford, where I was a Marshall Scholar, I started really honing in on this period right before what we generally consider to be World War II. You know, most Americans, when we think of World War II, we think of it starting on December 7, 1941, with the attack on Pearl Harbor. But there's so much more to that period, and I think it particularly resonates now with all of these debates that we're having about isolationism and America first, and that's really where that concept came from. And that was a period that really just grabbed my attention. And the story of the Flying Tigers, I think, is just the most fascinating thing from World War II and that whole period. And I think a lot of listeners might be familiar with the famous shark-faced image of the P-40 fighter plane, or have seen the John Wayne movie, The Flying Tigers, or maybe even the TV show Baba Black Sheep about Pappy Boyington. But the actual story of who these Flying Tigers were and what their mission was hasn't really been told before.
You know, the John Wayne movie is a fascinating part of all this, because the fact is that movie was rushed out in 1942. And from what you're saying here, most of the public didn't know about the Flying Tigers until late December of 1941.
Exactly right. So it's a great movie. It's not factually accurate. You need to read the book.
Okay.
But it's a great film, and kind of goes to showing, you know, how important the Flying Tigers were, in that period. So what happened was, you know, the Japanese invaded China in 1937. So we generally think of World War II from 41 to 45, but for the Chinese, it actually goes back to 1937, and the conflict does not go well for them. The Japanese are basically overrunning China, and the Chinese forces are pushed back into these couple cities, Kunming and Chongqing in southern China. And my story picks up with this kind of crazy tale that there's a handful of American pilots who are in China that far back, you know, 4 years before Pearl Harbor, fighting against the Japanese. And one of those pilots, his name is Claire Chennault, and he later becomes famous for commanding the Flying Tigers. But they are basically mercenary pilots who are there fighting with the Chinese Air Force. And what ultimately grows from that is this idea that's hatched between Chinese officials and also Claire Chennault, who I can talk more about as well, and American officials in kind of these backroom deals in 1940, 1941 in Washington, D.C., and this is authorized at the highest levels of the Roosevelt administration, to secretly send over American pilots and American planes to help the Chinese. And this is part of, you know, Roosevelt talks about how America is going to be the arsenal of democracy, how we're going to take measures that he calls short of war. And this is one of those kind of crazy schemes. There was even talk about, you know, maybe we'll send over bombers that will attack the Japanese. So that's kind of where the story comes from. And I'm really invested in, you know, the human story behind the planes and trying to understand who these pilots were.
So how did, walk us in then, how did things get started? I mean, what were the first moves to create what became the Flying Tigers?
So the first move is to create the Flying Tigers were basically these secret meetings in 1940, 1941. And the idea was, you know, we have these Curtiss Wright P-40s, and the Chinese wanted some assistance. So that was kind of the genesis of the idea. And then the idea was that you would secretly have 100 American pilots and a couple hundred ground crew who would leave their units in the U.S. and then travel to China to fly them and to fight against the Japanese. But obviously that would be an act of war if you had active U.S. military service members doing that. So these pilots had to leave the U.S. Armed forces in order to do that. And that's kind of, I think, at the core of the story is who were these pilots? And it's, you know, it's obviously such a crazy idea that you would kind of just leave everything behind while America's at peace and go and do this. And so I've spent the past number of years collecting the letters, diaries, combat reports, photographs from the families of the Tigers, and actually become very close with the families and the one last surviving Tiger to try and tell their story in as rich of a way as possible so you can really connect with them. I think a lot about, you know, a pilot like Bill Reed, who's from, you know, from Iowa, and he writes in his diary when they actually, most of them leave from San Francisco on ships, and they're carrying these secret passports or carrying passports with false identities that help to disguise their professions so to keep the mission secret. And Bill Reed writes in his diary about how this is the first time he's been on a body of water larger than a lake back home. And so for so many of these guys, these are children of the Great Depression who haven't had an opportunity to travel and see the world. And suddenly, you know, suddenly someone approaches them at a bar near an Army Air Corps base and says, how would you like to go to the Far East, make a lot of money, and get a chance to see combat? And that sounded like a pretty good idea. So for that, that's kind of at the core of this unit. Just a couple weeks ago, I was able to go talk to Frank Lozanski down in Columbus, Georgia, who's the last surviving Tiger. And he still talks about, you know, how excited he was about that adventure.
Wow, can't wait to hear more about it. We'll get back to it after a break. We are talking to Samuel Kleiner about his book, The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. So active against Japan even before Pearl Harbor. We'll get to the rest of the story in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us by phone or email. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Samuel Kleiner, a lawyer based in New York City, but with a doctorate in international relations, and he put his skills in research and international relations to work, researching the story of the Flying Tigers, the American volunteer group that set up to fight Japan even before Pearl Harbor happened. And the book is called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Questions, comments about what's going on here? You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, or emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk a little more about Claire Chennault, who was the leader of this group ultimately. Claire, a guy, and from Louisiana. Interesting guy. Didn't come to flying as a first career, though, did he?
Absolutely. Claire Chennault's a fascinating character, and I've been really lucky over the course of researching this book to get access to his letters, his diary, all sorts of things that, you know, people haven't really been able to see from him before. And so he's originally from kind of the backwoods of Louisiana. He falls in love with flying as an idea when he sees a plane barnstorming at a state fair in Louisiana when he's still a kid. But he doesn't get to become a pilot just yet. He goes out and he's a teacher for a while. He kind of struggles to make a living, finally joins the Army, doesn't get a chance to serve in World War One in the way that he wants, but finally gets to become a pilot. And he quickly becomes one of the Army's leading stunt pilots, kind of a precursor to the Blue Angels, and is going around the country doing these stunt performances at big air shows, which were incredibly popular back in that day. And at one of those air shows, he meets a gentleman who's a Chinese military officer who approaches him and says, would you like to come to China and advise the Chinese Air Force? And that wasn't uncommon at the time. You had U.S. Army pilots were going all over the world to kind of advise different air forces and help them get set up. But Chenault turned that down because he had a pretty good gig in the Army and had a wife and seven children. But he also had a very tough relationship with some of his superiors in the Army because of debates about the future of air power. And so by 1937, he's kind of forced out of the U.S. Army and decides that rather than retire back to Louisiana, he wants to go to China. And he writes in this incredible letter to his brother about how this is a chance to shape history for hundreds of years to come. And he leaves everything he knows behind to go to China and quickly falls in love with the country. And as they're fighting through the war that starts just a short period after he arrives, he stays with them. And that ultimately kind of becomes his home even after World War II, when he's become a U.S. Army general. By the end, he ultimately decides that he feels more at home in China than in Louisiana and stays there basically for the rest of his life.
Wow. So the bristling against authority in the Army makes it pretty clear he's a pretty good guy to run an off-the-books mission. And I get the sense from what we've talked about so far that this, I don't know, it sounds almost like rounding up a pirate crew. And I wonder if there was this other sense of, like, people who weren't that great in traditional authoritarian kinds of setups who they thought might do better in the Flying Tigers.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. There was, you know, a lot of tough relationship with authority for so many of these guys in the Flying Tigers. I think of Pappy Boyington as one of the pilots who really struggled with authority when he was a Marine Corps pilot and then kind of falls in with the Flying Tigers and struggles with authority there too, and finally finds his place later on during the war when he's commanding a unit called the Black Sheep Squadron. And he later becomes one of the most famous pilots in the war. So many of these guys were just kind of rough and tumble personalities, and that's kind of what actually brought them together and made them a cohesive unit. So there's just so many great stories from these different characters in the book, and part of the art was trying to, like, weave them all together to make it a seamless whole.
Claire Chenault himself was dealing with people right at the top. I mean, he sounds like he was got fairly close to Madame Chiang Kai-shek.
Yeah, he was very close with Madame Chiang Kai-shek, and she was kind of a sponsor for the whole unit. And Chenault, right when he arrived in China, wrote in his diary that she was going to be his princess, as he put it, because she was really kind of a mentor to him and helped to get this unit formed. And so many of these men became very deeply attached to the Chinese people and the Chinese cause as they were there. So even though the Flying Tigers were disbanded in July of 1942, many of the men would stay on there to fight for the rest of the war, and some were even killed much later in the war, fighting in China. So there were just so many different stories woven through there. And it's interesting to me because I think generally when we think of World War II, we think of things like the landing on the beaches in Normandy on D-Day or the flag raising in Iwo Jima. But we typically don't think of China as part of the theater of World War II. And part of what I was trying to do is, you know, help Americans understand that China was a very important part of American strategy. You had a million plus Japanese soldiers who were tied down fighting in China, and we don't know what would have happened if they would have been able to turn their full might against the United States. And to help us remember that China was part of this war, it's been called the forgotten ally from the war, and I think with so much going on with China today, the book helps to kind of give shape to a deeper understanding of U.S.-China relations and shows that we're not inevitably enemies.
Indeed it does. The book is called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Sam Kleiner is the author and our guest. So let's get a sense. I mean, we've heard of the Rape of Nanking, and there's a chapter about that in the book. Things were not going well for China against Japan from 1937 onward, and Claire Chenault was there to witness some of this, wasn't he?
Absolutely. So they kind of saw a lot of this going on. So there's the Rape of Nanking, and a lot of the Americans are there, and Chenault leaves right before that. And one thing that most Americans don't know about is the massive bombardment of Chinese cities. So I talk about, you know, the complete destruction of Chongqing that happens with the bombing campaign, particularly in 1938. And so a lot of this is kind of a preview of the kind of devastation that you're going to see later in World War II, because this is one of the first times where air power is being used in this kind of industrial setting. or on a massive scale. So there's just so many fascinating parts of the story. I think the most rewarding part, though, this, you know, there's obviously a lot in it that's quite depressing in that sense, but is important history to know about. But some of the most exciting part of the book for me was getting to know the families of the pilots, and getting to ingratiate myself in kind of understanding their stories. So one of the first big archival discoveries I had when I was working on this book, when I was at Yale, was finding a collection of love letters between a nurse, Emma Foster, and one of the pilots, John Petak. And they had met on the way over. She was originally from Pennsylvania and studied abroad in China as a college student and fell in love with the country and wanted to go back as a nurse. And when she got recruited to the Flying Tigers, she kind of left everything behind to do that. And they would go on these long bicycle rides when they got over there, when they were in Burma training, and fell in love and got married. And so these love letters are between them while they're in the Flying Tigers and separated because of the fighting. And getting that kind of perspective that these are real human beings and trying to understand who they were was what really excited me about the book.
You mentioned that Claire Chennault had seven kids. Did you were you able to make contact with any of them, and did they provide any materials for you?
I talked with a lot of the grandchildren. There's one a granddaughter, Nell Calloway, who lives down in Louisiana and has a museum dedicated to the Chennault legacy that's really incredible. And then also he had a couple children later on after the war from his second wife, Anna Chennault, and one of those daughters has been really supportive in this whole research and is what allowed me to get actually the best archival discovery. And the kind of the thing that makes the book the most exciting for me is the combat reports that are kind of at the center of it. So every day the pilots would come back and write these long reports about what they had done that day in combat. And normally those would be filed away in the National Archives, but instead they were kind of put away in Chennault kind of just kept them. And so they were collecting dust in a basement in Georgetown, and the Chennault family let me see those. So that's, you know, what gives this book so much character is, you know, being able to talk in detail about the air combat that these men were engaged in.
The book is called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Sam Kleiner is the author and our guest on The Exchange, and perhaps this is a conversation you would like to partake in. If you've got some stories to tell us or questions to ask of Sam, give us a call at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I am... curious. My father, who was a flying ace in the Second World War, just turned 99 a few days ago, actually.
Happy birthday.
And he's still pretty lucid. And I wonder if you would happen to know if there is... a place where we could go, where some, obviously it's harder for him to open up to his kids,
yeah,
rather than somebody like yourself. Do you have any suggestions?
All right, thanks for the question, Peter.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a wonderful question. I actually I mentioned earlier I've gotten to be very close with the gentleman who's now the last surviving Flying Tiger. He's a crew chief, originally from Detroit, Michigan, and I've got to spend a lot of time with him. He just has an incredible life story. And his son said something to me that was interesting, you know, that he would talk to me in ways that he wouldn't to his own kids about the war. And I do think there's something to be said for that. I think that, you know, it's wonderful that, you know, your father's still with us and the interest you have in recording his stories. And I definitely think that, you know, there's a lot of really great people out there, you know, if you just go online, who are essentially oral historians who can help you to work with your family on making sure that those stories are recorded. And I think it's an important thing because so much, you know, and I've actually benefited a lot from families who've taken the effort to record oral histories or, you know, ensure that letters are compiled into volumes and published. And that kind of stuff is really important just to kind of make sure that there's a record of what, you know, our ancestors' generations did. And it's an important contribution to history to make.
Peter, I would start with the Southern Oregon Historical Society, too. I mean, not a lot of staff there. It's all volunteer at this point, but they can at least direct you to somebody who might be able to take your father's comments. So thanks for that call. I want to ask about one of the other pilots, Elwin Gibbon. It sounds like he ended up at the center of an international incident pretty quickly.
It's one of my definitely one of the lesser known stories about that era, but just a fascinating one. He's a guy from Washington State who actually in the 1930s, he and his wife, and this is well before Pearl Harbor, go and join up with Chenault's outfit in China, and they're fighting against the Japanese. And after a certain point, he and his wife basically decide they've had enough of this and they're going to go home. And so they get on an ocean liner to go back to the Pacific Northwest. And when they stop in Japan, the police actually arrest Gibbon, and they threaten to try him as basically a war criminal and execute him. And this quickly becomes front page news in places like the New York Times, and threatens to derail U.S. relations with Japan. They ultimately free him, and he's able to go home. But I was able to find a lot of his stuff, and it's just an incredible, incredible story.
I guess I'm struck more than anything else by the short duration, really, of the Flying Tigers, because they were busy getting set up in Chenault had the original idea in 39, and then of course 2 years later we were in Pearl Harbor. And so how many did they get to fly, very many missions ultimately?
Yeah, it's an interesting question here. It's one of these things in American history. It's only really around for, 6-7 months, and fighting from December of 1941, their first battles on December 20th. So just a couple weeks after Pearl Harbor, and then they go through July of 42, so it's a very short period, but they kind of take on a much larger role. And that's I think, actually the most important thing I would say about the Flying Tigers and why there's so much historical interest in them, is because in the devastation after Pearl Harbor in December 1941, you also have a series of losses across the Pacific. So we lose Wake Island, the Philippines, the British lose Singapore and Hong Kong, and there's a real sense that we're going to lose this war, that it might not be winnable. And there's a fear up and down the West Coast of an invasion. So you have blackouts all along the coast. You know, San Francisco is blacked out. And all of a sudden, on the other side of the world, there's the story of these shark-faced American planes called the Flying Tigers, who are taking on the Japanese and winning. So the first article about them is in Time magazine, December 29th, 1941, just weeks after Pearl Harbor, carrying the news of this, good story at a time when that there was no good news to be had. And then following that, there were a series of victories they had that were very important. And there's actually, one of their missions, there was a pilot from Oregon named Ken Jennerstedt, who became one of the famous pilots from the unit because of a raid he carried out. So these guys were basically household names. And so much of that history has just been forgotten, and I wanted to try and recover that.
I'm struck by what a difference a month makes, though. If it had been revealed, say, in November 29th of 1941 in Time magazine that there were this group of American fighters, it would have been going against American neutrality and probably violating a law or two that to have this group over there.
Absolutely. This is definitely in contravention of the Neutrality Acts, and it's really just a remarkable assertion of America getting into this war in which we were officially neutral. So there's definitely a lot there that isn't kosher. But that was just kind of how Roosevelt felt about the war by late 1940 and 1941. He felt that America was eventually going to be involved, so we should do as much as we can to help the Allies. So that's kind of what makes this book so fun, and I think is the mix of this kind of backroom dealings in Washington, and then you're talking about how these guys are training in Burma and then quickly going into battle, and you have secrecy. It's really a covert operation more than it is a traditional military outfit, and the guys were kind of a motley crew, and they didn't really have to follow too many rules because Chenault didn't care. When I go and talk to the last surviving tiger, Frank Lozanski, he always talks about how they had a monkey living in their barracks when they first got over there, and would go hunting in the jungle in Burma while they were training. So there's definitely an aspect of, this is unlike any other story from the war.
So Claire Chennault had to bring a bunch of skills to bear, and we'll talk about the planes in just a few minutes, but he had to lobby, it sounds like. He was actually in Washington trying to twist some arms to get people to go along with this, and of course, this is when we're still officially neutral, not in war with Japan. So did he get to see FDR himself, or did he stop a few doors short of that?
Well, the main person was Secretary Morgenthau, and Morgenthau was the one who conveyed it to Roosevelt himself, kind of signed off on everything. So, but Chennault, you know, it's fascinating. In the span of a couple of years, went from being kind of a retired and somewhat disgraced Army pilot to kind of wheeling and dealing in the highest corridors of U.S. foreign policy. So it's also kind of a story of his own journey and redemption through this process.
The plane shopping and the eventual adoption of the P-40 as the airplane for the Flying Tigers with shark nose paint. I mean, what was it that made Chennault decide that's the plane we need for this unit?
Well, it was more just the one that was offered to them. So they had the Curtiss Wright P-40 was available, and they kind of took what they could get, and that kind of became the iconic plane that they had. But Chennault always was always complaining for his duration in China about how they needed better planes.
The stories earlier in the book about just the woeful unpreparedness of the Chinese Air Force that Chennault found when he got there are kind of depressing, because they just couldn't do much right. And even when they did fly missions, they couldn't get the bombs to land in the right places and stuff like that. All well told in the book, The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. We'll take a short break and come back and talk more to Sam Kleiner about his work. And we can take phone calls and emails from you as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with The Flying Tigers, Sam Kleiner, and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Samuel Kleiner, a lawyer based in New York City, but he also has a doctorate in international relations. And so he looks into international relations just pre-World War II and comes up with the story of the American pilots who fought for China against Japan before Pearl Harbor was a thing, before we got into the war against Japan. The book is called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Glenn in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sam Kleiner. Glenn, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention that the Chinese still appreciate the contribution that was made by the Flying Tigers. They have a small but very nice museum that they operate in Chongqing, which was Chongqing, and it's to the Flying Tigers. It's a Flying Tiger Museum, and it's a very, very nice thing to visit. It happens to be directly across from what was, once the war started, as far as we're concerned, General Stilwell's location there in Chongqing, and what had been his headquarters. By the way, Chennault got along much better with the Chinese government during the war than did General Stilwell.
Which is a part of the book, too. Thanks for bringing that up, Glenn, and for telling us about the museum. I assume you've been to the museum, Sam, or have you?
Looking forward to going over, but I've heard so much about that and talked to a lot of people who've been involved. The fascinating thing is that this history is much better remembered in China than it is in the U.S. So you could find a number of kind of Flying Tigers museums in China, but you can't find those in the U.S. And that's been part of a complicated process for how the Chinese remember World War II. You know, because this was the nationalist regime. For a while, they didn't really talk about this history as their own in the same way. after the communists won the Civil War. But there's been an attempt in more recent years to kind of claim it as their own history, and that's a really fascinating thing to kind of see happening. And so many of the Tigers, when they would go back, you know, their story isn't particularly well known here, but they would be basically greeted like heroes on the streets in China. So that was just a fascinating thing to see. And I think it's important for us to remember that history here as well.
And then Glenn mentioned General Stilwell, who was the American commander in China. He and Claire Chennault did not have a very good relationship, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the fascinating parts from the war is that they had this kind of very contentious relationship. And, you know, Chennault never did well with authority and certainly didn't like Stilwell. It's just such a fascinating story.
We have another call here from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sam Kleiner, the author of The Flying Tigers.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's a fascinating story. I was trying to remember, and I cannot, the financing behind this. I know that at that point, China in the 30s was still very agricultural, had, you know, in pockets, of course, of manufacturing, et cetera. So they didn't have a lot of international relations or currency. So how did they finance both this unit as well as finance, you know, buying the military hardware to fight against the Japanese war machine?
Okay, good question, Connie. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and so much of the and the kind of way in which these were paid for is complicated. It kind of came out of a U.S. aid program, so that's how a lot of this was ended up being financed essentially by the U.S. But there was always a shortage of supplies for the Flying Tigers and more broadly in the Chinese Air Force, and that's part of what motivated the program was the sense that China had used up most of its planes over the course of the war, and they weren't able to get replacements for those. So it really was a war that was where the Chinese were very desperate, and that fueled the need for these kind of crazier ideas like having American planes and pilots come over to fight for them.
There were some. You mentioned one story of a woman nurse, who was with John Petack. Were there other women in the crew, part of the American volunteer group?
Yeah, there's another nurse. Less is known about her, so I'm mostly focused in the book on Emma Foster, who was the nurse that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then they also, of course, had a relationship with Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who I talked about earlier, and was an important kind of a sponsor and a mentor for the group.
It sounds like she did most of the work. Did Claire Chennault or anybody else from the crew ever get to visit with Chiang Kai-shek himself?
Yeah, they would visit with Chiang Kai-shek on a number of occasions. There's portraits of Chennault with them. So they, you know, one of the fascinating things is they did have a relationship with people at the highest levels of government, as well as kind of all different parts of the governmental structure there in China.
I want to come back to Connie's question about funding, though, because it seems like there had to be some interesting workarounds. You mentioned the arsenal of democracy approach that FDR was taking, and that created things like the Lend-Lease program to provide some war material for the Brits that didn't run afoul of neutrality in place at the time. It must have been even more creative, though, for the likes of the Flying Tigers.
Absolutely, and this is, I think, kind of where you see some of the prototypes for things that later become quite common in these covert operations. But you have essentially these shell companies that are set up to kind of transport the planes over in private hands so that you don't have, you know, official U.S. government involvement. So companies like they call China Defense Supplies that are very involved in this process, and a whole host of fascinating characters in Washington that kind of help make that happen. So guys like Tommy the Cork Corcoran, who was one of the original D.C. lobbyists who had been a member of the Roosevelt administration, is very involved in that process. So there's a whole chapter that's kind of dedicated to explaining that process. But it really sets up the kind of, you know, shady backroom dealings that we come to associate with U.S. foreign policy much later, and shows actually that happened in some ways much earlier than we generally expect.
I did find myself thinking that a blueprint was being made here with the Flying Tigers for later covert operations when there came to be first an OSS and then a CIA that followed it.
Absolutely. And after the war, actually, Chenault starts an airline that operates around Southeast Asia called CAT, and that secretly was a private airline of the CIA. And so a lot of the Flying Tigers end up kind of becoming involved in different covert operations around Southeast Asia at that time. And in the 1950s, when the French garrison at Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam or Indochina, as it was called then, was under siege, and it was a French colony at the time, Eisenhower made the decision not to send American assistance in, you know, which was kind of not getting involved in this war. But we did send in CAT airplanes to bring in supplies that were former Flying Tigers who were involved with that effort. So you do see kind of a direct line from the Flying Tigers to these later interventions that happened post-World War II in Southeast Asia. And it wasn't until the 90s that the Flying Tigers were officially recognized as a unit, and the covert action was kind of brought to light. And their lawyer, and kind of representing them in this effort, said, you know, this really makes the Iran-Contra effort look like child's play.
Okay, so there's an example of stuff that came later that used the same template that the Flying Tigers had set up. Let's take a call here from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sam Kleiner, the author of The Flying Tigers.
Hi, I'm going to throw a bomb, and before I do it, I want to say that I respect the heroism and the patriotism that was associated with every pilot involved with Flying Tigers. My father served in India during the Second World War on the Hump. So I come from that background. But I have to ask, what's the difference between the Flying Tigers and the Abraham Lincoln Brigade? What's the difference between the Flying Tigers and Hezbollah? What's the difference between Flying Tigers and the guys that go fight for ISIS? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thanks for sharing that, Paul. Great to hear about your father. You know, it's an interesting question. You know, I think that and some of the guys from the unit would always bristle at the insinuation that they were mercenaries. And I think that, you know, part of it was these guys, you know, there was an official authorization from a government. And so it does kind of lay the framework more for, you know, how we think of covert operations happening later, you know, with a mix of official government authorization, but is somehow still kind of off the books is how I would think of it.
Yeah, but I do see where his question comes from, though, the idea of people who are authorized, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, by their government, but not officially attached to them, off in other countries, taking part in activities that affect somebody else.
Absolutely, and I think we see that a lot in, you know, around the world today, where different kinds of fighters are fighting, you know, in some different way with authorization from different governments. So I think it's, you know, in some ways it sets that up, and it makes it all the more important for us to engage with this history.
All right, so politics aside, I want to come back to some of the aesthetics. We have talked about the shark painting, the shark teeth on the front of the P-40 planes used by the Flying Tigers. Where did the idea for that come from?
It actually comes from a magazine. Like all great ideas, it kind of has very accidental roots. They had these planes, and they were kind of making all these different decorations on them, and finally decide that, you know, they actually saw when they were in a magazine this had been on an Australian plane and thought it looked great and put it on one of the P-40s, and Chenault liked it and said that was going to be their emblem. So that kind of became the official symbol for the unit and definitely became one of the iconic images of America at war.
It truly did, and interesting again to think about the fact that this unit was pretty much out of action by July 1942. How did it get the name Flying Tigers? We haven't even talked about that part.
It's a great question, especially because the plane obviously looks like a shark, so it's kind of this discongruity. And that seems like actually, you know, and there's various different theories. Some people will tell you that it, you know, came from the Chinese people who's in December 1941 saw that fighting and, you know, thought that they looked, you know, like Fei Hu, the Flying Tigers. But it actually seems like it probably came from a marketing strategy back in Washington. The official name was the American Volunteer Group, and that just doesn't have a Greek ring to it. So the first time it appears in writing is in this December 29th, 1941 timepiece. And it seems like the editors there, you know, in concert with some of these guys who were working behind the scenes, came up with the idea to call them the Flying Tigers.
All right, so a marketing term attached to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is better than just calling them AVG. Flying Tigers is much more exciting. How ready or not was Chenault's team by the time Pearl Harbor was attacked in early December 1941?
It was around 300, so it was 100 pilots and a couple hundred ground crew. And I've tried, you know, as best I can to tell as many of their stories as possible. And there's just so many of them that are fascinating characters. I think of Pappy Boyington, who's from the Pacific Northwest, grew up in Idaho and Washington State, fell in love with flying when he was at an air show as a kid, and really was down on his luck when he joined this unit. And so for many of these guys, this was more a chance for them to get away from something than to sign up for a specific fight they knew they were getting into.
I did not know his first name until I read your book. Greg Boyington.
Yeah, Pappy was the name that he acquired later on in the war when he was with the Baba Black Sheep, or with the Black Sheep Squadron, and then went on to, he became a very famous pilot and was shot down later in the war and survived time in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. So his whole story is really told through the lens of the book.
Was his story fairly typical, and did the same thing happen to Claire Chenault, for example, where they rolled into the real military and not the adjunct as that they were when the war started?
Yeah, so in July of 42, they were finally rolled into the Army Air Corps, and actually most of the pilots went home at that point and then would later rejoin other units or in many cases go back to China. And they had a tough time getting home, so I talk in the book about how this Bill Reed, who I've mentioned before, kind of has to find his way home, and a lot of them end up on this ship that goes to New York. And Bill Reed is from Iowa, and his buddy R.T. Smith from Nebraska decide they're going to have a great week out in the towns. They go to all these fancy nightclubs and have a raucous party. And then Bill Reed gets on a train, and he goes back to Marion, Iowa, where he's from. And I saw the original newspaper clips about this in the local newspapers. They talk about how this is the largest celebration this part of Iowa has ever seen before. A huge parade. The governor comes out to speak, and Reed just kind of thanks everyone for their their support. And he ends up going back to the war and is killed in 1945 and in China and kind of returned to support Chenault and finish the mission. And so many of those stories, like the story of Bill Reed, haven't really been told before. And what I wanted to do with this book is to make sure that we're honoring that legacy. And I think, you know, with Memorial Day approaching, it's an important thing for us to keep in mind. And I hope that listeners, are piqued enough with their interest to check out the book. There's a lot of unpublished photographs, so even if you and so many stories here based on the original archival documents, that even if you've heard a good amount about the Flying Tigers or this part of the war, there's a lot of stuff here that's very new.
One of our listeners did ask about bibliography. I don't see one of those, but there are copious notes, and so you do track your sources back to where they came from.
Yeah, the end notes are incredibly extensive, and we actually had to almost cut them down because they're so extensive. But yeah, this is a ton of archival stuff. So this isn't this is actually me going out and finding combat reports, letters, diaries, original newspaper clippings. So if you're really into this stuff, this is the place to get it.
It is truly fascinating. The book is called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Sam Kleiner, the author, and our guest on The Exchange today. Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.